A man has been arrested following an armed siege in the West Dublin suburb of Blanchardstown, during which two Gardaí were shot. The Gardaí were in a housing estate in Clonsilla when a man opened fire from his home. Both Gardaí received non-life-threatening injuries. Nicola Tallant, investigations editor at the Sunday World, is on the line. She joins me now. Nicola, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, how did all this begin and at what time?
But shortly after 7 o'clock, it began. The guards were called to that address there in Blanchardstown and Clonsilla area. And when they arrived, there was a man, a chaotic individual, shooting at them from the window. So obviously there was backup called. The ERU, the Emergency Response Unit, highly trained and skilled and armed, were brought in along with negotiators. So there was a standoff, which appears to have gone on for at least 2 hours. The guards were injured and were taken to hospital. There's a lot of talk about them not being life-threatening injuries and that they were, you know, just small injuries. But to be honest with you, this was a chaotic scene. A well-known criminal who has been involved in serious organised crime for more than 2 decades. And he was not a trained sniper. Those same bullets that went into the foot and the arm or hand of those guards could quite easily have gone into their heart or their spines. This was a chaotic situation, highly dangerous.
Eventually, you did reach out. How did that go? I mean, was the help there?
Unfortunately, it wasn't. And it was paradoxical, really, Pat, because my biggest fear was that the children would be taken from me. And at the same time, I was very much aware that my other biggest fear was that they wouldn't be taken from me. And that we would all end up, dying together. So I did reach out for help. Yes, I did. And I remember it was a Friday, at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I rang the HSE and I spoke to a social worker. I didn't use my own name because I was frightened to, in case literally they'd send somebody around to take the kids from me, and then I would have no reason to keep going because I'd heard horrible stories about how once your children went into care, you never got them back again, you'd never see them again. And I thought, the only thing that's keeping me earthside, as it were, is the fact that I have these children and I want to do the best that I can for them. But the response from the social worker was that they were closing at 4:30 and there wasn't anything they could do for me. And if I thought I was going to hurt my children, I should call the Gardaí. And she gave me the number for Garda headquarters in the Phoenix Park. And I just thought, that's ridiculous. That's no use to me. I don't even live anywhere near the Phoenix Park. It just didn't make sense. And this sense of abandonment was quite acute. But in a way, it made me... It kind of struck a little bit of defiance in me, Pat, because I kind of thought, well, if I go and kill myself this weekend, my girls are going to be left with people like that. And if that's the best that Ireland has to offer, I'd better kind of hang on for a little while and see if I can just keep going and see if I get better. Because, of course, I turned everything inwards and I blamed myself for my mental ill health, for my reaction. For my anxiety, for my own stress reaction to trauma. But unfortunately, the flip side of that, Pat, is that I did consider on more than one occasion killing myself and the children.
The rationality of that thought at the time, it's clearly, when you look back on it, it's not the right thing to do because life is all they have. To take them with you because you feared for what fist they would make of life in other people's care, is not a rational thought now. But at the time, it appeared absolutely the right thing to do for you.
It completely did. And that, I think, is something that isn't understood by the greater population, that a suicidal mind is a very logical mind. You know, we can rationalize our situation to ourselves and our solution, which is suicide, very, very coldly and very logically and very clinically, to the extent where we think, well, if this is life, then life is crap. And I don't want this. And I don't want this crap for the people who matter more than anything in the world to me. I don't want my children to have to go through life, if this is life, because I've gone through decades of things not getting any better. And things getting worse, and by things I mean my self-esteem, my confidence, my ability to claw myself out of the darkness into some sort of light. God, even if it was candlelight, it didn't have to be sunlight, but just something to have hope. And I think that was a huge issue for me, that I did not have hope. I didn't have hope for myself. So therefore, I couldn't understand how there could be any hope for my children. And I thought that the most loving thing I could do was to end all of our lives. And I know that that is completely irrational. In fact, to be very honest, that's the definition of a psychotic break, really, isn't it, Pat? Where you have, you know, if psychosis is not being able to see reality for what it is, then that was definitely a psychotic break. And I'm really just lucky that I'm here, but it shouldn't be down to luck, because what happened was I did manage to get through that horrendous weekend, and I trundled along a little bit, and I spoke to my GP, and I was put on a waiting list for mental health services, but that was, I don't know if I'm even still on that waiting list, to be very honest, and I'm only being slightly flippant about it. I mean, and the problem is that the response from the health services is 6 weeks when you're in crisis, 6 weeks or six sessions rather of therapy, and that's really not enough.
So how did you get the help, though, that you're here, so you got through it? I mean, did you get professional help? Did you somehow muddle through on your own? Were the services ultimately there for you?
No, services were not there for me. I say it to you again, it's luck that has me here, and it shouldn't be.
Some of the texts coming in on foot of the interview with Hazel. A fantastic interview. Me too. I have been there. Thank God this depression is being accepted now, says Mary. Another one. We're all glad that you stayed, and I'm sure your kids are too. Your honesty is so powerful and will help people to hear your story. Please forgive yourself, because if you could hear what I heard this morning, it is the voice of an amazing, strong woman and mother. That's from Paul. Thank you, Hazel, for articulating so clearly how you felt. The services for mental health difficulties are absolutely impossible to access in this country. Many mothers go without much needed support with the culture of just get on with it. The next one, I can totally relate to this woman you're talking to. Everything she's describing is how I felt too. Although it was a long time ago, it still rears its ugly head. What a simply brave, wonderful woman. Well done for speaking up about your struggles. The next one, there are so many for Hazel. Just to say, the mother speaking on the radio is very brave. I feel so much sympathy for her and for Deirdre Morley. People need to be aware that mothers need to feel safe to ask for help. That's from a Kilkenny listener who adds, the mental health services are shockingly bad with long waiting lists and so on. OMG, listening to that lady speaking at the moment, huge respect. You are an inspiration to your girls. Unbelievable interview with your guest, such a brave and articulate woman whose children are lucky to have such a strong and determined mother. Well done for choosing life. The world is a better place for your presence in it. We had a text from one of our listeners early about you, and I mentioned that you were going to be on. And they were referring to how nobody expected you to win at all.
That's
on Strictly.
Right.
And they were saying that it was a classic example of people characterizing people by how they appear and not by how they perform. And it turns out that you were, well, certainly as a child, a closet dancer, were you not?
Well, I don't know what. I've always loved dancing. You know, any opportunity at a sort of family event or a function, I just love it. I mean, I was never trained. I never knew what the hell I was doing, to be honest. I just fling myself about. And but I've always loved it. I loved the sensation of it. And when I was a kid, I think my mum She loved dancing. She loved watching ballroom dancing. She watched the, you know, the forerunner of Strictly Come Dancing, you know, Come Dancing,
Come
which
Dancing,
was this sort of,
yeah,
you know, which went for, you know, broadcast for years and years and years. And she absolutely loved it. And she was always getting her dad to dance. And my dad was like, no, I don't dance, you know. So then she said to me, well, there was actually a dance school across the road from where I grew up in the West Country, in a little town called Keynsham. And so she sent me along for a couple of lessons. And I had one lesson, and it was, I got to say, I mean, it obviously left an impression. I mean, I must have been 12 or 13 or something. I was a bit self-conscious as a sort of gawky teen. And so I felt very awkward being, you know, being shown around the steps by this dance teacher. And I think I went for one more lesson we had, and that was it. And I just, you know, as a teenager, it's like, oh, stupid. I don't want to do that. It's embarrassing. You know, none of my friends are doing it. But, you know, it's something which I don't know, maybe just rediscovered a latent ability for it. Certainly, as you say, I mean, I don't think anyone really thought I would. I think everyone thought I'd be the sort of the comedy, you know, the contestant who'd be like, get by on just a bit of goodwill for the first couple of weeks, and then it would resort. I mean, I fully expected to be fired out of a cannon or something at some stage. You know what I mean? Like dressed, yeah, as a sort of a woodland animal, you know, and then, you know, dance the cha-cha dressed as a giant badger or something. You know what I mean? Like, that's the kind of where I thought it was going to go. And I was quite happy with that, as I thought, you know, I'll play along. But then Otie was very, very, she sort of recognized, she sort of thought, you don't want to let yourself down here. I said, well, no. I said, I mean, I want to do it properly. I want to kind of show due diligence and respect to the art of dance. And so she said, all right, and well, let's keep training. So we would train for hours and hours and hours, way beyond everyone else. Like, you know, it was sort of like half past five in the afternoon. I'd see all the other contestants going past the rehearsal room. And I'd say to her, where are they going? And she said, oh, no, they're going home. I went, oh, is that it then? And then she said, nope. No. Yeah. You're staying for another,
you see,
5 hours.
I was thinking, Bill, watching you, certainly in the early stages, people would be saying, it's not necessarily that he does it well, it's that he does it at all. But it turned out that was an impression which was really wrong, because, as you say, you demonstrated great skills and a lot of practice. But I mean, when you look back on those performances, I'm sure you spent hours every day looking back at your Strictly performances. What do you make of the man you see on screen?
Well, firstly, there's on several of the occasions I'm looking at that thinking, how did I do this? How? And then I look at the steps and the moves, and actually I think, well, I remember, you know, going over and over and over this, but I'm slightly taken aback by it. I've got to say, I never thought I'd be able to sort of pull it off.
You set up social media pages to honour the memory of your children, to keep their memory alive, I suppose, to help people really see elements of your children's lives behind the headlines that have been there. And it seemed like a fantastic thing to do.
Well, it was to keep a promise to Connor. On the night they died, on the 24th of January 2020, I was standing outside the house. Our house had become a crime scene, so I was standing outside, probably in shock and fairly stunned and bewildered. But you're just thinking about the kids, and for me, I thought about the last time I sort of held them and kissed them and hugged them, and for me, then I thought about the last sort of promises that I hadn't got round to keeping. So for Connor wanted a YouTube channel. So he wanted to put some comedy sketches together, which we were all going to film as a family and put those up. So alas, we didn't get the chance to do that. So the next best thing for me was to create a YouTube channel in his name. And I supported that then on social media to make people aware that Connor's Clips was on YouTube.
Yeah. Now, you also set up other pages for your children. What was Snowman for Carla about?
Well, Carla, again, her promise was she wanted a snowman. And we hadn't had much snow in the last while. So I think in November 2019, I was able to scrape together something about the size of a pint glass And she kind of looked at me as if to say, is that it? But she was a big fan of colouring. So I'm hoping to launch a colouring competition later this year in Carla's name. And then Dara wanted me to start coaching with Rathcoole Boys that he played for. Himself and Connor played for Rathcoole Boys. But Dara was about much more than that. Dara was in every club and society in Newcastle, Sagan, Rathcoole. He got involved. He got his head stuck into everything. So his charity will be encouraging people to get involved and to participate as Dara did. And that's the name of the charity, As Dara Did. So that's what we're hoping to do is raise funds to help clubs and societies to get people to participate.
Now, this would all be a very positive story against the background of tragedy. But then there are always people out there who spoil things. Tell me about the Connors Clip Facebook page. What happened?
Well, I have quite a positive experience on social media, on Twitter, and ironically on Instagram, which is owned by Facebook. And the Facebook page itself on the Connors Clip's Facebook page was absolutely brilliant, and the support I got through there. But over the past year and a half, I've directly seen myself absolute horrific comments made about me and my family and Dee. But particularly last year, I was actually going to abandon Facebook last year. There was one horrific, horrific comment that stunned me when I saw it. It was later removed. And unfortunately, I didn't get the chance to take a screenshot of it, but it was absolutely appalling. It was somebody claiming to be that they knew the family and they knew the facts of how the children died. Now, this was even before the Gardaí had compiled all their evidence. And this is a person who was not known to any of us in the family. And for them to be allowed to post something like that, and then, I suppose, gain support for an absolute scandalous lie with other people rowing in behind that saying, oh, wasn't aware of that, didn't know, you know, the family, oh, it's good to know this, I was feeling sympathy for them. I was stunned, Pat,